Yes, Mr. Harlan.
Are you a grandparent yet?
No. I'll guarantee you that it will not have that picture up there to start with. Because Mama has spoken. But right now we're in Romans because Stephanie has not tumbled. Therefore, I am not in Dinuba. We're in the book of Romans. And last time when we had gotten together, we were halfway through, and I stopped in mid-sentence, but just sort of set the context for those who weren't there. We are looking through the book. We have finished the introduction. We are in the first major section on sin, and we are nearing the close of the section on Gentiles who are guilty before the throne. And in that section, we saw the reasons for Gentile guilt in verses 18 through 22. We saw that they suppress the truth, that which was known about God had been pushed away from them by their own volitional actions, that his visible qualities, both his eternal and divine nature, could clearly be seen. Therefore, Paul says, we are out with an excuse. In fact, we put it this way. God got angry because of those things. In verse 18, we saw that the truth was suppressed. In 19 through 20, that his truth was ignored. 21, he wasn't honored. People were ungrateful in that same section. And his glory was given away. We spent 4 Sundays looking at reasons why God gets angry, why his wrath is being revealed. And then we moved into a section that deals with, therefore, God gave them over. And we've seen 3 times God gives them over. We saw, first of all, he gave them over to a body that was dishonored. This is where man did with women that which is inappropriate outside of marriage. We looked at sexual immorality and all kinds of things. And we saw that wasn't enough, that man continued to rebel against God. So God gave them over to passions that drove to them to do that which was unnatural, to have relationships, women with women and men with men. And today we'll get to the section where God gives them over to unrighteousness. Now we're just going to begin that section. You'll notice that's a very long section, verses 28 through 32. And we didn't even get through verse 26 last time. Actually, we got through 26. We just stepped into 27. But we're going to pick up that story there, where God has 3 times given them over. He gave them over to sinful desires. He gave over to shameful lust. And today we're going to see he gives them over to a depraved mind. But before we get to the depraved mind, by the way, I just really appreciate Pastor Galen give you such a wonderful introduction to each of my messages. You know, he set you up and told you that Timothy was told to watch his mind. Well, that's where we're heading. I mean, he and I are in sync. It is absolutely amazing how God is just working to make that happen. But we've seen, as we move through here, we were in verse 26. It says, therefore, because of this, God gave him over to shameful lust. Even the women exchanged natural relations for the unnatural. We talked last time that women are the safety valve in society. And when a woman begins to do that which is unnatural, society has really become corrupted. And we looked at that. And then the verse continued. In the same way, men also abandoned their natural relationships. Men committed indecent acts with other men. And we were in the process of looking through this section. And as we stepped into it, we saw that we came to this passage where it says, and they received in themselves the due penalty for their perversion. And we left it there. We were on this slide when we stepped away last time. And I said, you know, there was so much I wanted to talk about, because this is the law that we've seen throughout the book of Judges. We've seen it throughout the book of Ephesians when we studied it. We saw it in Galatians when we went through that book. But it's the law, what I like to refer to as cause and effect, or the law of sowing and reaping. You know, Galatians, Paul puts it this way in the 6th chapter, in the 7th and 8th verse. It says, do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. You sow apples, you're going to harvest apples. And so it says, be careful. The one who sows to please his sinful nature, from that nature will reap destruction. The one who sows to the Spirit, from the Spirit will reap eternal life. That's Galatians 6, verses 6 and 7. It's in this passage that Paul refers to a destructive nature. And he says God has given them over to this perversion. God's given them over because they practice this idolatry. They refuse to give him honor. They suppress his truth. They were ungrateful for what God had done for them. And therefore they have this due penalty. That is the judgment that's coming. God's judgments are never arbitrary. They're never capricious. They fit the crime. And throughout this section, in verses 24 through 32, the theme has been the abandonment of the defiant sinner to the consequences of their sin. God doesn't do anything more than says, well, if you don't want me, maybe I just should step out of your life and let you experience life without God. You, after all, you don't want to give me honor? Well, let me just give you over to the enslaving sins that you've chosen to practice. The penalty that you receive is due to your perversions. Because you have perverted truth. You've suppressed it. You have perverted gratitude. You've become ungrateful. You have perverted natural relationships between men and women. And you practice adultery. You have become so perverted that you are now women with women and men with men. And God says, this is going to have its due effect. And we got to the topic where many people like to teach that AIDS is God's vindictive thing upon the homosexual community. And personally, I believe that's bad theology. The Bible doesn't say it was AIDS. And I think we have to be very, very careful of jumping on a bandwagon. Because first of all, God doesn't do anything halfway. And if that was judgment, every homosexual would have AIDS. And no one who wasn't would have it, because that was God's judgment upon that community. But it's not. That's not the case. So we need to be very, very careful. The scripture says they get their due penalty for their perversion. Whatever due penalty is, God's going to bring it. And it's probably unique to each individual. Because it talks about how they have rebelled to them. But we do see the patterns in scripture that those who practice polygamy tend to die early, interestingly enough. Those who do not practice proper marital relationships and harmony tend to have problems that come into their life, stresses, all kinds of various things. The gnawing, unsatisfied of the lust itself, wears at them and tears them down. It's a dreadful physical and moral consequences of their debauchery that takes place. You know, those who take drugs those who take them through IVs, get problems with the needles because they overuse them. They get the due penalty of what they practice. They practice perversion. God brings it to them. It's sort of like the law of gravity. You can sit there and deny it all day long, but that doesn't mean it's not true. Many people get killed when they violate God's given laws, and it's not accurate to say that God killed them. God allowed them to be foolish, and their foolish actions killed them. Because of what they do. It's not that God caused them to sin. It's not that God wanted to have malice. It's not that he's a cosmic killjoy sitting up there with a bolt waiting for somebody to sin so he can zap them. That's not the God of the Bible. But God does establish natural laws. And he says if you violate nature, you do that which is unnatural, there are consequences to actions. You jump off the cliff because it felt good. The law of gravity is still going to take its effect. And you know, no one's ever been hurt by that fall. But that sudden stop has sort of racked them up. And people seem to see they're in a fall and they say, well, I don't have any problems. What's going on? You just haven't seen the last chapter. But there's splat coming. Marriage was given while man was in a perfect state. Notice when Genesis 2, when he says, for this cause shall a man leave his mother and dad and cleave to his wife. And the teacher, this is prior to the fall. Marriage was given when God was establishing a beautiful gift to how things should happen. And yet, there are passages. There are passages where God makes a statement that seems almost out of character with God. Jeremiah 7:31 is an example of this. It says, they built the high places of the Tophath, in the valley of Ben-Hinnom to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire. Something I did not command, nor did it enter my mind. Now, this is God speaking. Now, how can the all-knowing say, it didn't enter my mind that they would do these crazy things? They would offer their children as sacrifices. This is what we refer to in theology as an antinomy. An antinomy is not a paradox. A paradox is two things that appear to be true and can't both be true at the same time. An antinomy is two things that appear to be contradictory but are true and are consistent. We just don't have in our finite mind the ability to understand it. But God says, when I created the valleys, when I created all this nature and I put it out there, I had no idea that man would be so sinful. Of course, he had all knowledge. And so we have to be careful how the verses get translated, but that's a faithful rendering of the Hebrew. But it's not God saying he didn't know, but he's saying, of all the plans, I could have made man a robot, but I gave him free will. And the purpose of giving him free will, he has a decision. And he can decide to do that which would never have entered my mind to have done because he's free to do such. It's not that I set men up because I am all-knowing, all-powerful, and I can stop them. Yes, that's all true. But then I would make us robots. And God chose to make us free moral agents. And as such, when we come to these passages as God gave them over, it's quite often taught that God caused them to sin. And that's a misunderstanding of teaching of Romans, I believe. They sinned because of their very nature. And their nature, the problem isn't that they sinned. The problem is they denied God. And in the denial of who God is, they gave him not his due. They suppressed the truth. They were ungrateful. The end result is that God says, okay, you like that? Fine. Let me give you over to that so you can really experience what it's like to be life without me. Let me give it to you so that you understand what's transpiring. They received in themselves the due penalty for their perversion. That which was due to them because of what they have done. Not because God willed it to them, not because God was a cosmic killjoy, but because God wanted to. John MacArthur put it this way, the appalling physical consequences of homosexuality are the visible evidence of God's righteous condemnation. Unnatural vice brings its own perverted rewards. God intended it and indeed marked their lasciviousness passions. And he frowned upon them and he called them, move away from these things. These things are not so to be. But you have to believe me. If you suppress truth, if you pay no attention upon me, the effect upon your body is not all you're going to have. You're going to see effects upon your mind. Homosexuality tends to a debased mind, to sink man below the level of the brute, to destroy insensibility, to bear the consciousness, if you will, with a hot iron, to sear their consciousness, Paul writes to Timothy in the passage that Galen was in this morning, in the section just before there. The last remnant of reasonings of the conscience, it seems, has been extinguished, and they begin to practice unnatural, degrading vices. Henry Muir, in his book, puts it this way. He says, sin comes from the mind, which perverts the judgment. The effect is retribution is to abandon the mind to that depravity. They sink further and further into sin. The effect is more than on the body and the mind. It's also on the emotional, relational component. God gave them over. They're almost stuck in their homosexuality. Remember last week we talked about some statistics that the average reported number of homosexual relationships, according to the U.S. Department, and according to their websites, not the Christian websites, not the ones that are trying to bash them, is over 500 relations in a lifetime. Stan and I were talking last time. I said 500 is an unbelievable number. Bert, remember the number reported in the Chronicle? 2,000 relationships, meaningful ones. It's mind-boggling how we can make those statements and put them together in the same sentence. How do you have 2,000 meaningful relationships? Most psychologists tell us you can have maybe 50 to 60 close friends. And yet, we've perverted relationships. I saw a hand.
What was the percentage of that?
No, this is saying the average, when you average up all the ones that are reported, when they ask them to report how, what their number of lifestyles and what's going on, U.S. Department of Health is capturing statistics. And this comes from the gay lifestyle website where they talk about what's going on. Meaningful relationships. And they're almost, I read it and I said, hey, you know, my faith teaches me monogamous, one relationship, one man, one woman. And I'm sitting there, I'm going, 2,000. Because I quoted 500 last week. I thought I was being generous. I wasn't trying to, that was the one that came from the U.S. government. But Stan pointed me back. I went and did the research and looked at it. And the numbers are right, Stan. 2,000 are reported. You were absolutely correct. It's just mind-boggling. It gives to them this idea. They have bad minds of depravity. They think it's right. And I read those things, I go, am I warped? Do I just miss this? Yes, Lynn.
I question that from keeping track of how many. I mean, it's 365 days in a year. When they, you know, that.
But when they say that the average homosexual has a relationship within 1 week, it means they move into the practice. That's why we have to, well, why do you worry about someone just making a statement? The statistics are telling us that over 90% enter into a relationship within 1 week. I'm recording from their website.
I'm still questioning how they're keeping track of 2,000.
I do not purport to know. But what I do know is that the scripture is telling me they receive to themselves the due penalty for their perversion. And from that, I sort of want to make two closing points before we move on to the next giving over. Because I want us to look back at phase two and realize this is because of this, God gave them over to shameful lust. Even their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural ones. In the same way, men abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed with lust for one another. Men commit indecent acts with other men and they receive in themselves the due penalty for their perversion. A contextual and exegetical study of what I just read up there reveals by most of the commentators that Paul is putting out a prohibition against homosexuality. Now, people tell me the Bible never says that. Well, I have a hard time when I'm reading through this. And I'm saying it seems pretty clear to me that Paul is saying this is not something that should be practiced. He's making a statement. Oh, Jesus never said. Okay. I believe that's true.
That's true, but he has a greater, higher standard. He talks about if a man or woman, if a man even thinks about adultery or any kind of sexual perversion, he has a, you know, that relative is a higher standard.
Yeah. The question I want to ask us as we close on this topic, because I don't want to dwell on it, but I do want us to get a perspective. Why is this important? Why is sexual sin such a serious offense? I don't know if you thought about it, but when the Christian church first met for its first major debate, the Jews were on one side, the Gentiles were on the other. The Gentiles have been practicing homosexuality for years. The Jews found it abhorrent. They all came together and said, how are we going to be together as one church? And we have the Jerusalem Council. And in the Jerusalem Council, they established four things. They said, these are the majors. These are the things that matter. You are not to eat blood. You are not to eat food sacrificed to idols. You are not to eat strangled animals. You are not to engage in sexual immorality. It's interesting. Three of them dealt with dietary. One of them. Why did this get added to? Because the whole issue was over what you eat. And they met on what people were eating. In the midst of talking about what people eat, this phrase on sexual immorality gets thrown in at the Jerusalem conference. We call it the Council of Jerusalem. Yes?
You asked why.
Yeah, why?
Well, I think that it has to do with what you do to your body.
Yeah.
And these kind of relationships, we know in homosexual relationships, there's an AIDS epidemic, but also in sexual relationships, there's also disease.
Oh, absolutely.
This concerns the Lord.
I think it concerns the Lord greatly, yes. Ah, our bodies are temples. And maybe what I take in and eat is equally what I take into my mind and what I actually do to my... Maybe they're all interrelated. Very good point, Julie. I think, you know, marriage has always been God's living metaphor. I gave you a hint earlier when I said, before the fall, God gave an example of what relationship was supposed to be. Because he wanted to relate with Adam and Eve. And he said, I will give you marriage as a type. You may understand what human beings may have with me, what I have with the God, the Son, and God, the Holy Spirit. That we have unity. I want you to describe to you what is going on. He gives them marriage. And then we see the picture throughout the whole Testament. It says, the nations go a-whoring. The nations go and play the role of the harlot. And God wanted to have a relationship with his wife Israel, but Israel played the role of the harlot. We find the prophet Hosea describes God's love for Israel, and he compares her to the unfaithful wife. But he says, I'll keep taking her back, because when she wanders away, I still love her, and I still am concerned. The New Testament describes the church, the redeemed, as being the bride of Christ, the wife of the Lamb. And this metaphor promises us is not something unknown to us. We studied throughout the book of Revelation. We talked about what... So people are like, why is the church so hung up about the definition of marriage? Because it's at the heart of who God is with his people. It's a definition about an intimacy and a full commitment that's there. And it's a commitment for life. As Paul will say over in Romans 12, offering our bodies is a living sacrifice. It's part of our spiritual act of worship. And the commitment to be loyal and devoted to serve as a husband and wife. And Paul goes through in Ephesians 5. Remember we studied the book of Ephesians? I know this was 1986. But in 1986, we went through the book of Ephesians. And we talked about what God meant when he put them together. When we choose to say yes to a spouse and we just choose to be committed to them, both in our attitude and our behavior, the metaphor is the same as saying yes to Christ and being committed. And in choosing him as our partner for life, it's a potential to say, I will not be distracted. I will be committed. And he says, be careful for those who disear the mind, who try to teach something different. That God, our creator, has chosen. He's created us, his creation, to be his bride. And he wants nothing else coming between that. And he says, you start practicing. I'm going to let you go practice it because I don't want you as a false example of what true marriage is. And he says, I don't want these things getting in the way. When you make a commitment to be true, I want you to stand for it. I want you to know which is natural, because natural is what I am. I am the God of nature. This is against nature, what it says in here. They do unnatural things. Though marriage and commitment are purity, God reveals himself to us. When we are in Christ's body, we say we are born again. We defy the flesh that we've had before. We said that was a sinful body, but God is making us anew. Behold, old things have passed away. New things have come. And he's saying to them, when you know Christ and you make himself known to you, this is important. And it's not something. And if you're not going to be part of that relationship, then fine, I will withdraw myself and not contaminate you with my ideas and my thinking. In fact, it's humorous in one sense. But I want to move over. I want to ask the question, moving to the third thing that God gives them over to. Because it's interesting. First thing, it's own marriage relationships. Then it's unnatural relationships. And the final thing, it says it's a depraved mind. And that depraved mind results in all kinds of unrighteousness. In verse 28, we'll read about the depraved mind. We're going to spend the rest of our time this morning on that topic. But in verses 29 through 32, we're going to see a laundry list, an unbelievable list of depravity. And the record that's recorded there. And so as we start to look it over there, it puts it this way. Furthermore, since you did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God. Now, this is the fifth time in this verse since 18 we are seeing that man has chosen to suppress truth, to reject God, to deny him. It's said in different ways, but as he moves through here, for the worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, he gave them over to a depraved mind, so that which ought not to do that which ought not to be done. They have become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceitful in mouth. They are gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. Wow, right in the middle of all that other stuff. Obedience to parents. They are senseless, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Wow. We're going to have a fun time going through those words. Although they are known God's righteous decrees that those who do such things deserve death. They know they deserve death. But something. They not only continue to do these things, but also approve of those who practice them. You talk about a depraved mind. They not only applaud that I'm doing this, they're encouraging others to come practice with me. This is where we're heading. I want you to see the end state as we pick this thing up. So let me set the stage, if you will. Let me just ask you some questions. Do you retain God in your knowledge? Do you enjoy thinking about God and trying to understand Him? What information do you fill your mind with? My wife this week was talking to me, that Philippians tells us to be careful what we put in our mind. And she gets something from a dearly beloved church that we have to be members of. They tell us of a website they'd like us to go check out. And all the thing was pollution in her mind. And she was very offended. She called her favorite elder to talk about what the church is communicating. Her favorite elder went into ignore mode. Trying to figure out what's going on. But it is important what we put into our mind. Do you find hearing a sermon or after reading the Bible that you can't remember what the pastor just talked on? Can you not remember what has been said? Do you have trouble holding on to the knowledge of God? Menopausal what?
I'm menopausal, yes.
Professing to be wise, they are honest. Our sinful nature doesn't want us to know God. So Satan's going to bring things into our mind. So we need to fight this. We need to be careful. Even religious people and many theologians have this wonderful theory that you should avoid Bible study. Pardon me. You need to read God's love letter. I'm absolutely amazed the number of times I turn on and I see these wealth and prosperity gospels. I say, don't let the Bible get between you and your relationship. Send your money in. We'll take good care of you. And I'm going, what do you mean? Whoa, 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 whoa. The Bible is what matters. It is the hallmark of what's going on here. And yet we set up our own dogma. Do we honor God with our minds? And then God rewards us. But you know, if we don't reward God with our minds, be careful what we're doing. God can give us over to a mind-blowing experience that's not very good for our minds. We receive the due penalty thereof. Beware of those Christians who discourage Bible meditation. Be wary of those who tell you that it's all about your experience and not about what God says. It doesn't matter what God says, what you experience, it matters. Let me tell you, your feelings can mislead you. It's about the facts of what God says. Now, I was raised in the ministry of Campus Crusade for Christ, and we had this wonderful illustration of a train. And the engine was called fact. The coal car was called faith. And the caboose is called feelings. And so often we take those our faith and we shovel it into the caboose. We say, I want to feel good. You know where the train goes?
Nowhere.
Nowhere. But we take our faith, we shovel in the fact that God says this. You know, it's often said, God says that I believe it, that settles it. That's not true. God says it, that settles it. Whether you believe it has nothing to do with it. We need to believe what God says and not necessarily what we think or what we feel. And so as we begin this section, I want us to be careful. For there are Christians who would replace God's truth in the Bible by teaching you that you need to live by your experience. And while I think experiences are good, and I'm not against experience, I mean, I teach shape. And when the E on shape is experience, it's important to understand. But it is not the driving factor. It matters what God says. And we start with S, spiritual. And we end with our experience. Because, you know, if you get the caboose following where the engine's going, It goes where the engine goes. It just naturally happens. But if you shovel that coal into the caboose, you put a lot of weight to have to haul, and you don't have anything moving the train. So we need to shovel into the facts and ground ourselves in them. Corrupt thinking leads to corrupt behavior. He gives them over to a depraved mind, and we see all the depravity that followed afterwards in verses 29 through 31. We will learn today that people knowingly in their conscience, if they examine themselves, do things that are worthy of death. They know it. It's not a denying of it. No one denies. They say, yeah, I know that's wrong, but I'm going to do it anyway. It amazes me when I hear that statement being made. But it shows you the state that their mind is in. They'd rather gather around them who do the same thing because misery loves company, I guess. There's one characteristic I think we can agree on about homeless. They are loud. They are demonstrators. They know what they believe. And they're passionate about their belief. I'm not saying that they're right or wrong in their being loud. But it's a characteristic. Because I think they are trying, because they're not thinking, to raise the volume. To deal with the issues. Because they can't find it from God, because they've denied him. They try to find it from mankind. They try to get all mankind to come along. Well, someone was saying something.
What they do sometimes is put us to shame because we won't stand up for the things that we believe in.
Ah.
And they will, and we have more foundation to support what we believe in than they do.
Right. The scriptures, we look here, it's progression. Three times in this chapter it says God gave them up. Stage one was a breakdown in the social order. He was given over to inappropriate heterosexual immorality. In verses 24 through 25, we study that God gave them up, if you will, in terms of their hearts, their passions, their desires, which resulted in sexual immaturity and the dishonorment of their body. Stage two, in verses 26 and 27, we saw the breakdown in the social order. The practice of what's referred to is homosexuality. We studied how God gave them over in terms of their soul, in terms of their being, in terms of who they were, to have to leave that which was natural, to begin to think that which was unnatural. Why can't I marry my dog? Why? Why does marriage have to be between a man and a woman? Why can't it be between me and my dog? I love my dog. I want to marry my dog. It's just the natural consequences of a depraved series of thinkings. The problem is not, by the way, the immoral behavior. The problem, by the way, isn't homosexuality. I don't want you to hear me wrong. The problem is they denied God. I want to go back to the root cause. The others are just activities that happen because of the natural consequences. But the issue is they denied God. The problem is making another human being something they worship. Instead of worshiping the immortal, they chose to worship the mortal. They suppressed truth. They were ungrateful. I mean, this whole context we're going through in 18 through 23 that led up to this thing laid out the groundwork. So what caused it? These are the results. The problem is the idolatry that degrades the hearts and minds. Marriage does not solve the problem of sexual impurity. You can be married and still be sexually impure. Because people who are married have many problems too. The problem is the husband and wife must center their life upon Christ. And if Christ is the head of the marriage works. Otherwise, they just have yet another institution that doesn't seem to make it work. I wish we could say man having the right relationship with other people would work, but we've proven that man's inhumanity to man is pretty bad. Unless God is there, there's a problem that happens. So we ask, what is the consequences of God's wrath? In one word, it's degradation. It's a downward spiral. There's a progression of God's wrath that's being described here. God's wrath affects our hearts, our bodies, and finally our mind. God's created us to be special. God created us in his image. But we've infected that image. Man's heart was supposed to be a fountain of love. Man's body is supposed to be a fountain of labor and work. Man was created to work. Man's mind was to be a place of creativity and imagination. But we get those things out of order. We get those things, we take God out of them. We begin to have perversions of depravity We become fountains of sick and disgusting things. Spiritual degradation is a progressive disease. And it leads to, where was it here? It leads to be filled with every kind of wickedness, of evil, of greed, of depravity, of envy, of murder, of strife, of deceit, of malice, of being gossipers, slanderers, God-haters, insolators, arrogators, and boasters. I'm actually changing the text because I'm reading what it really says. You know what I mean? Try to make it nice to read. You go through these 18 items that are in here. They are just one Greek word after another. There is no they are. That stuff's all been added by the writers. They become doers of evil, disobeyers of parents, senseless, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Every time he changes the thing, and we'll study through this as we go through these passages. He starts off with a bunch of verbs. He moves to a bunch of adjectives. He goes back to a bunch of descriptive nouns. Why does it exchange that way? What they're trying to teach us. We will move through that. And they come to the goal, they have righteous decrees, and what they've done, they deserve death. They not only continue to do these things, but they approve of those who come and practice with them. This is the depravity. This is the fountain that's flowing full of evil, for lack of a better term. Jesus put it this way over in Luke 17. He's speaking to his disciples. He says, things that cause people to sin are bound to come. But woe to the person to whom they come. It is better for you to be thrown into the sea with a millstone around his neck than for him to cause one of these little ones to sin. So watch yourselves. You see, when we cause people to practice sin, Jesus says, I have something for people who cause people to practice sin. I have an abomination. I'm going to withdraw my restraining forces. I'm going to pronounce death. Death in the Bible is spiritual separation from God. I'm going to separate myself. I'm going to give you over to those things that you like because you're going to be underneath my wrath and my judgment. Paul puts it this way. Furthermore, since they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, he gave them over to a depraved mind to do what ought not to be done. Interesting play on words. We'll see it here as we go through. There's a slide that illustrates it. But I just want to point out to you here. It says, you don't think about me? Fine. You're not going to think at all. Says, you want to talk about right thinking? You don't want to think right? Good. You're not going to think right. In fact, you're not going to think. Your ultimate thing God gives them over to is a depraved mind. Men did not approve of God and the idea of retaining God in their thinking, so God gives them over to a disapproved way of thinking. Men reject God, so God rejects man's way of thinking. By letting loose, and he tends to lead them to both illogical and irrational behavior. This is the pattern we see here. Douglas Moo, in his commentary, writes a phenomenal statement in this paragraph. I want you to see it. It says here, people who refuse to acknowledge God end up with their minds that are disqualified from being able to understand and acknowledge the will of God. The result, of course, is that they do things that are not proper. As in 121, Paul stresses that people who have turned from God are fundamentally unable to think and decide correctly about God and his will. The tragic incapacity is the explanation for the apparent inexplicable failure of people to comprehend, yet alone practice, biblical ethical principles. Once the work of the Spirit in renewing the mind can overcome this deep-seated blindness and perversity. You see, there is a way out, but it needs to be a rebirth. God gave them over for the purpose of bringing them back. He did not leave them abandoned to the view, but so often we get there. So, digging into the text, it puts it this way. Furthermore, this is just the third time. You saw the therefore, and because of this, but each time that little Greek word come. And it simply can be translated and also, even, but yet. This time the NIV translator chose to write it furthermore. They're creative in their use of verb. Since they did not think it worthwhile. And what you're going to see on the slides this morning, I changed the format a little. Because often I put up there the Greek and I explain the Greek to you. And I've had some people come and say, but Bert, I don't understand Greek. How can I learn what you do? So what I've done is I've lifted 15 translations Because I personally believe with any five of them, you can get 90+% Probably close to 95% what I get by reading the Greek. You won't see the puns. You won't see the play on words. Unless you read the Greek, it's hard to see them in English. Sometimes English words aren't play on words. But you can read through them. Since they did not think it worthwhile, the New American Standard and the NIV say, just as they did not see fit. The New Revised Standard, the English Standard Version says, since they did not see fit. The King James, the authority, the authorized text. Since they did not like. Noah Webster actually writes the exact same translation of that, as well as the New King James. Even as they refused, the authorized, the American Standard Version, or the World English Bible writes, the New Living Translation puts it this way. When they refused, Darby says, according as they did not think good. Young, from what we get in Young's Concordance, Robert Young, writes, according as they did not approve of. Bishop, which is actually all the bishops of the Episcopal Church that existed prior to the being of King James. It's called the Bishop's Bible. They got together and did a translation because they become Anglicans and they didn't like the Douay, which is the Catholic Bible of the period. So they went and put their Bible out that would teach Episcopal thinking to make King Henry the VIII okay. So in their translation, as they regard it not. It's the original King Jimmy speaking. It's almost Middle English when you read it. But what I thought we would do as we look through that is I wanted to talk a little bit about Bible translations before I delve into the text, because I wanted to give you some background and help you to understand what's going on here. I teach out of what's referred to as the NIV, the New International Version. It was published in 1984, and its goal was to create a Bible that was both scholarly, but also informal. Because when the Greek was written, it was written in the Koine Greek. It was an informal. That's why you'll see contractions in the NIV. That's why you'll see English that's more easy to read and understandable. It's not exactly word for word correct, but they went with a style that basically said, phrase by phrase is good enough. We want it readable, understandable. On your handout I gave you this morning, I put all the stuff written out for you so you wouldn't have to take detailed notes. But in that handout, you'll see there that it's written at the 7th grade, 8th month reading level. It is the lowest written reading level of modern translations that are reliable. You can read Good News for Modern Man, it's actually at the 6th grade reading level, but I have a lot of problems with that particular translation, and calling it a translation is even bothersome to me because it had a lot of biases. It didn't translate scripture, it taught a theology. But if you read the NIV, it's a very readable, understandable translation. Another very, very good translation is what we refer to as the NASB. That stands for what?
New American Standard.
New American Standard Bible, that's right. It was written in 1977 when it's finally published by Zondervan. Zondervan owns the copyrights to it. And the 1977 version of it is probably the most widely regarded, the most universally translated of all 20th century developed Bibles. It is known throughout the world as the best English word-for-word translation. The problem with it, it's a little choppy to read. Because it is word-by-word dead accurate. But the problem when you're word-by-word, it doesn't necessarily, we don't speak Greek. We don't put our verbs at the end of sentences in English. And so we tend to have problems when you do a word-by-word translation because it doesn't come out very readable. And therefore, it's a great study tool. But it's not one that's really easy to read out loud. And as such, I think it's healthy to understand it. It was first written in 1963, by the way. They published the New Testament at that time. It wasn't until 1971 the entire Bible came out. And in 1977, it had been updated 6 more times. And it has become the gold standard. So if you order a New American Standard, you'll get the 1977 version of it. It's the one the Thompson Chain Link comes in. It's the one the Open Bible comes in. The Keyword Bible, the Reformation Bible. All the ones that you order, you'll get the 1977 text. But it was updated in 1995. A lot of people don't like the 1995 update. In its most recent editions, one of the things they decided to do in the 1995 update was to go through and try to remove the antiquated words and phrases and many of the conjunctions, and added some things that made it less wordy, made it easier to read, but no longer as accurate in terms of being a word-for-word translation. And a lot of purists who said, that's what we tried to do, stop mucking with good success, stayed with the 1977 version. So I would bet if you have a New American Standard in front of you, you probably have the 1977 version. You probably do not have the 1995. You're over back there.
Yes.
You should get the 77 because they did create some mistakes they had in typos in their text in the between 71 and 77 when they actually came out. But the New American Standard remains the most literal version of the Bible that you could probably find out today in modern English. And it's a very good. I'm not anti-New American Standard. It's just hard to teach. It's hard to read. If we move on to the next one, the King James Version, sometimes referred to as the Authorized Version. Have you know it was never authorized? It was never called the King James until 1844. King James happened to call a committee together and said, I need you to go off and put together a Bible that corrects the problems of the Greek Bible. Because the Greek Bible essentially copied the Latin. And the Latin didn't have the most accurate manuscripts of the time. So the Greek Bible had lots of trouble in it. And so, if you will, the King James Version was a New American Standard version of its day. It was a literal word-by-word translation into Elizabethan English. The problem is, it's in English and no one ever spoke. Even the English didn't speak that right. But it was dead accurate. And it was very good as a translation. And it stood the test of time to a lot of people. We have a whole movement out there called the King James Movement. If it ain't the King James, it doesn't count because it's the authorized text. Unfortunately, it was never authorized. The Great Bible was authorized. The Bishop's Bible was authorized. King James was the only one that was printed. So everybody had to use it, but it was never authorized. You can't find any proclamation from the king or the queen ever making the Bible, the King James, that version be authorized. Unfortunately, it had so many other problems. All they stopped printing all the rest of it. It was the only Bible that was printed for over 200 years. Right. In fact, if you actually read the preface of the New American Standard, they'll tell you they went back to the King James. It's one of their basic texts. Because they all came out of the same root of development. The NIV actually went back to the Greek and said, forget everything else that's been written. We're going to read the Greek and we're going to translate it phrase by phrase. Almost every other translation has a predecessor that says, you know, our people like this one, so we're going to model after it, and when there's a choice, we'll refer to it to keep people feeling comfortable. You'll see that in the column I gave you where it said, it reads, derived from. And the NIV isn't derived from anything. That's when you read it. I've never seen that anywhere else. Well, that's the way the Greek reads. Unfortunately, the NIV decided to help make it more readable, so they added a bunch of words that aren't even in the text to make it more readable. They rarely change the meaning, like they added they are, instead of calling them gossips. They said they are gossips. The word is actually gossipers. That's an awkward word to say. Yes.
What about the New King?
We're going to get there. We're going to get there. You see that next one up there? The New King James came out in 1962. 1982, and it's published by Thomas Nelson. Well, we're talking about who owns the copyrights. So far, the King James, by the way, is in the public domain. You can copy it all you want. No one can say anything to you. The Lockford Foundation owns the New American Standard. You can't use it without buying it. You can buy the rights to reproduce it. They do sell them, but you need to pay for them. The NIV, by the way, I've purchased the rights to use it. It comes with my computer software. I have the right to copy it and display it and hand it out in any handout, and I'm perfectly legal. So as long as I stay with the NIV, I'm legal. I have permission to copy it. The New King James, their goal was to go through the King James text and the most recent manuscripts available By the way, it was a committee made up of 33 Baptists and a few Presbyterians. Because they said, we love the King James, we just need to update it. There were no Methodists, no Episcopals, nobody else. It was made up of none but Baptists and Presbyterians. That didn't get King James. Help you understand who's on the translation board. Not that it matters, but it's just important to know what doctrines you may find when you read through things. And the version that came out, it's a very readable translation. They went through and they cleaned up much of the Elizabethan structures and syntaxes of the King James. They got rid of all the speaketh and doeth and iseth
and
thous. And they got rid of the second plural plurals that didn't exist in the Greek nor in our modern English. And they're all through Elizabethan English. And they made a very readable but King James-like version. And if you read the preface of it, it states in there, we write such that when the King James is read, and if you're following along in the New King James, you can follow the text. There's only a few words you're going to change. It's written in the same iambic pentameter. It's written in the same sequence. They try to make the phrases look almost identical. And every now and then they'll update a word when it's archaic. So it's not a bad reading if you have trouble. The New King James translation, as you look through it, I believe I told you earlier, it's written at the high school level, where the King James is actually at the 12th grade, 11th month. The graduating class might be able to understand the King James and all the words that are written in it. They didn't do much when they approved it. They moved it down to the beginning of 12th grade. But they approved it with the New Revised Standard Version. Was written in 1989. It's a revision of the 1952 Revised Standard Version, which was a revision to the 1901 American Standard Version that we'll see down here. So it's just one of many cascading texts that are long. And its purpose, when it was put together, it was put out by the National Council of Churches, and it was to be an ecumenical group. They wanted to make sure that everybody, so Baptists, Presbyterians, Episcopals, anybody that's a member of the National Council of Churches, had the rights to participate in. And the reason they did the New Revised Standard Version was a guy threw a rock in a cave, a little place called Qumran. And they found something called the Dead Sea Scrolls. They said, whoa, we need to check these out because our Old Testament may not be as accurate as we thought. Lo and behold, 25 years later, it's as accurate as we always thought. But they put a whole committee together to go off and to study and to revise the thing in light of the new knowledge they were going to learn from the Dead Sea Scrolls. You'll notice most of the Old Testament didn't change. They cleaned up some things in the New Testament. And in particular, they removed a bunch of archaic words that even had been true in 1952 that are no longer in our vocabulary in 1989. And they decided to remove gender bias because there was a lot of people that said the scriptures always say he and brothers. And so you'll have them like brothers and sisters, he and she. And they went through and they made a gender neutral version. When the text did not specifically have a gender, they always made it gender neutral. They did not perpetuate a view of always had to be a he. That was one of their goals. When you read the preface of the New Revised Standard, what they were trying to do. It's not a bad version at all. They'll think it read theirs or human beings instead of he, or mankind instead of man. Things like that. They're not substantive changes, but they move it to a gender neutral if the text in the Hebrew and Greek didn't have a gender. The King James and every other version prior to that, prior to the Revised Standard doing its work, had in it gender bias because they always wrote with he as a default. The authorized version, the American Standard Version here, the ASV, was the first Bible that came out in 1901. Decided to not put a capital he and a capital him. I still capitalize every time I use the word deity. So you read my notes, I don't know, I was brainwashed. When you refer to the deity, you always capitalize. I don't care if it's he, him, his, whatever. You'll notice when everything I ever write for you and hand out to you, my pronouns are always capitalized. But in defense of the American Standard Version and the Revised Standard Version, Greek was written in all caps. Hebrew doesn't have capital letters. It's all in one case. So there's no way to say, well, the original had it capitalized. No, the original was all caps. in Greek and had no case in the Hebrew. And so to come back and put it in there is just showing you a bias. Now, I'm biased. I'll just tell you I'm just biased. It's not biblical. It's just bias. But I think it's a good bias. But anyway, the ESV is actually the version I would recommend you read if you don't want to read the NIV. It's an interesting translation. It's the English Standard Version of 2001. Essentially, the people who did the New Revised Standard Version went a little bit overboard in their theology. And they ran into some problems. And they consistently, they took out, should be born of a woman instead of born of a virgin. And so some of the conservative evangelical scholars didn't like that work. So they published the English Standard Version, which is nothing but the Revised Standard Version updated, much like the New Revised Standard Version did. But they took out some of the gender-neutral language that was offensive, because you lost doctrine. It's not a young woman. It's a virgin. There's nothing wrong with that word. I'm going to put it back in the text. And so their version, the English Standard Version of 2001, was put together basically to deal with the gender-neutral stuff and the stuff that was doctrinally put out there. And their preface said, we wanted the traditions of Tyndale when he did the first English translation, and the King James, to be accurate to the scriptures and let them speak, but do not to separate from them. And it bases itself, by the way, upon the American Standard Version and the King James as its lineage. So if you're like reading those things, you grew up with, you'll find that phraseology very much you feel comfortable with, where the NIV will do its own thing. Then it goes back and just translates it. It's not going to be familiar. That's why every time you read those NIV, you go, I don't remember reading that way. The NIV is a new translation. It's not based upon anything that was old. My favorite translation that I'm reading right now is called the NET Bible. Guess where it's found? It's the New English Translation. The purpose of the people that started this was to put a Bible into the public domain where there would never be a copyright and everybody could publish it freely and everybody could use it and no one would make any money on it. Because they said, we're not going to have a copyright. Copyright's only there to preserve it, you're making money. We don't want to make money. We're going to donate our scholarship. This is a version that has more footnotes than text.
Is it accurate?
It's dead accurate. What the NET does is, as you go through, there's a little footnote. The footnote tells you why they translated it the way they translated it. So it tells you the bias. We had these three choices. We chose this because of that. So you'll read a phrase and there'll be three pages of text explaining why they translated it that way. That's why it has to be on the internet, because you can never publish it. But it's a very readable translation. And it goes through lots of explanations, a lot of stuff about what's going on there. It's actually in print now. They went back with extensive notes. It was done by more than 50 biblical scholars who studied the original Hebrew in each book. So each of them had 20 or so people debating with each other what the term should be. Yes, ma'am.
Is that the website then? So
if you just Google New English Translation or NET, it'll show up. The NET Bible. It's a registered trademark, so no one else is using it out there. It was originally decided to be on the internet. It was desired published way to be published on the internet. You could actually download a PDF, put it on your palm, put it on your BlackBerry, CrackBerry, whatever you're addicted to. It comes on CD-ROM, and it's free. That costs you absolutely nothing to pull out. It was started in November 1995 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. A group of people from the Society of Biblical Literature decided to put together a translation that would be non-sectarian but heavily evangelical. And it does not apologize for its evangelical flavor. It's conservative, it's literal, but it has a lot of the NIV type of readability. It doesn't actually look like any other translation, because it too also went back to the original text. And it tells you, unlike the NIV, why they translated the way they translated, with gobs of footnotes. Now, if you don't like the gobs of footnotes, it's hard to read. But if you're looking for what goes on to it, and it's an open translation process. They explain what it is, and on the net to be debated, you translate it wrong, everybody else can come out there. It's sort of the Wikipedia of Bibles, if you will, where everybody has a right to comment, no, you didn't translate it right, people can argue with each other, and there's a committee that publishes it, and there's an update all the time. And it's free for downloading, and it's able to be used anywhere in ministry you want. American Standard 1901. I need to hurry up, but I need to finish these Bibles today. 1901 was the original American version. The English of 1844 tried to revise the King James. They basically thrown out the American translators. The American translators got miffed. So in 1901, they actually published their own version called the American Standard Version. It was referred to the American Revised Version, then it was called the American Standard Revision, then it was called the American Standard Revised Bible, then it was called the American Standard Edition of 1901, then it was called the Standard. Why? Because every seminary in America taught from this Bible up until the advent of modern Bibles. It became like the King James. It was the only one you could find in seminaries. It was referred to as the Standard. It was, what Bible are you? The Standard. Which other one would I read? It's the Standard. It's the one that the New American Standard Version comes from. It was based on the King James, but updated with modern English. We basically, this version is a very interesting version because from it, the Revised Standard flowed, the Amplified Bible flowed, the New American Standard Bible, the Recovery Bible, the World English Bible, Kenneth Taylor's The Living Bible paraphrased. He based it upon this Bible as his basic text that he used. Most of them don't go back to the original language. They go back to the ASV because it was so well done. The problem was done in 1901, though. We don't quite speak the same way. Not bad as the King Jimmy, but not quite as good as modern English. So we have the World English Bible that is still being worked. That's why you see the Old Testament came out in 1997. The New Testament came out in 1997. The Old Testament was completed in 2005. And every month they update it. Like the Net Bible, it's an internet-based Bible. And it's a group of people working on it. And they're trying to build a translation in modern English that's not copyrighted, that has new archaic, and is not basic English. Because there have been so many watered down to try to put it in really simplified English. This is not written for people with English as a second language. This is people with English as your primary language. And it's modern English and it's powerful words. It's a great another one to read if you're trying to figure out what a text might mean in modern English. And so if I was looking at the New American Standard, the NIV, the New King James, the English Standard Version, the Net Bible, the World English, that's seven. Pick any five of them, and you'd probably be in good shape. The New Living Translation was based upon Kenneth Taylor's. He wrote that wonderful book called The Living Bible that was written for kids. It was a paraphrase. Paraphrase, he didn't try to keep anything doctrinal. He just wanted to make sure his kids could understand it. It was written at the sixth grade reading level. But so many people loved it. He said, hold it, you're teaching bad doctrine from what I wrote. Not like I wrote it for my kids, I didn't write for you to teach bad doctrine from. So he sat down with a group of 60 other scholars or so, and they came up with a New Living Translation that's based upon his paraphrase, going back to the ASV's 1901 text, looking at the latest manuscripts, looking at both old and new, trying to put it, and came up with a translation as opposed to a paraphrase. It's called the NLT. And it was done by Kenneth Taylor and a group that did the original Living Bible. It's a very readable translation. It'll also blow your mind because it doesn't look like anything else you've ever read. It's not as popular because it came out late behind the NIV that had basically solved that problem. But it's out there. For examples, they did choose, however, to move to a gender neutral. So you'll see things like, so God created human beings, and these human beings he created in his image. When the text reads, God created man and woman, they just said human beings. They didn't want to move to anything. God bless those who are the peacemakers, for they should be called, the text reads, sons of God. They read, children of God. Matthew 25:45 says, and he answered them, I will tell you the truth, that you refuse to help me. Anyone who refuses to help me are worse than these, my brothers, who are refusing to help me. They wrote brothers and sisters. They were one of the women incorporated in. Probably Jesus did not mean males only, but he did what he did. A translation I would not recommend is Noah Webster's. His job was to fix the King James. He just written his dictionary. He said, go clean up all the words. I think he changed 185 words. So you're essentially reading the King James. But if you want, a lot of people like to brag about Webster. I just put him up there. I list him on the list so you can see. Essentially, he's a carbon copy. Everything King James has, he says. This is a really antiquated word. Interesting one is Robert Young's. Young, who put together Young's Concordance, did a literal word-by-word translation. It is probably makes the It makes the New American Standard look readable. Makes the New American Standard look readable. Because this one is extremely difficult to read. Because it is the most accurate translation ever done. Because he made sure every time he used that word, he only used it that way. Where the New American Standard said, no, come on, guys. It clearly meant something different. So I'm going to use a different word to distinguish it. Young says, holy, that's translated bias. I'm going to be the literal. It is word for every time this word is used, he picked one English word for each Greek word. That's the only one you get. You get none of the nuances. We may have other meanings. Very, very literal Bible.
Didn't he translate from the Greek?
From the Greek and Hebrew. Personally, he and 60 other people on his team. Darby, the founder of the pre-millennial movement, the Plymouth Brethren Church, writes the Darby translation. Another excellent translation, but full of premillennial bias. I happen to be a premillennialist, so I love the Bible, but my uncle, who's a down-in-the-wood Calvinist, would roll up his grave if he knew I was reading Darby. Then we have the Bishop's Bible. We talked about it. Written in 1562 prior to the King James, revised in 1572 prior to the King James in 1611. It's the Bible the Episcopal Church basically wrote to have the Protestants to have their Bible. They didn't have to go to the Catholics to get approval to have a Bible. And it's the first Protestant Bible that was out there. To be fair, the Douay Rheims is the Catholic Bible of Catholic Bibles. For years, it was the King James-like edition. Until you got to the modern 20th century, when you got the Jerusalem Bible, and you got the Revised Standard Version for Catholics. There wasn't a modern Catholic Bible. This is the major Catholic text. And most people call themselves traditional Catholics prefer to read. It is, if you will, the King James. But King James is the Protestantism. This Bible is Catholics. And it's a very readable, very good translation. It dates about the same period of time. So, we will look at it as we go farther through these things here. We'll notice in weeks ahead, and I'm not going to always do this, but in this particular lesson, I just want you to see, it's not that much different from the Greek than what you're getting by reading a few translations in here. And by the way, what I love the New American Standard, every now and then they come along and put in words that don't exist to, it's not just the NIV, this phrase here, to acknowledge God any longer. Is in the original text. They'll at least give you the courtesy of italicizing it, but since I italicized text is already italicized, it's hard to see, so I just put a line through it so you'll know that the text writer knew that he added it to the text. So as you read through this translation, here they have two different versions depending on what year it was published in the Darby. So Darby said sometimes he had there and sometimes he could make his mind whether it was in there or not. So he put it in brackets and said you could read through. Anyway, we're going to stop there today. We'll pick up verse 28 next time. But I wanted you to understand the readability of the scriptures. And I was going to encourage you, get 2 to 3 translations as we go through the rest of Romans. Because I think you'll learn more from the text if you read it. Like a Monday, read it in the King James, a Tuesday, read it in the American Standard. On Wednesday, read it. We're only doing one verse. It's not going to take you long. The nuances you'll see are important.
One quick question. On your handout there,
Yes, that's the Greek text. It is the most accurate Greek text that most modern evangelicals use. The other text that's there beside that is the Textus Receptus, the received text, the Byzantine text, or the Text Majoris. The Text Majoris. All those are quoting phrases. It was another Greek text that was out when the King James was originally done, and it leads to a different reading. Then you will read if you read. That's all my Greek that you see up here is the Nestle text.
Okay. Can you go back one?
I certainly can.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's pray. And then I'll answer questions for you afterwards. For those who need to leave, I'm already 10 minutes late. Father God, we thank you that there people are patient with me for being late today. Father, may we honor you as we honor your word. In Jesus' Baptist name, I pray. Amen.